Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. My guest today begins her new book with this: you can create transformative change only by facing the truth. And that's probably why she called her new book Facing the Climate Emergency: How to Transform Yourself with Climate Truth. So what does she mean by climate truth? Simply this: scientific consensus says a climate emergency and an ecological crisis threaten everyone on this planet. So in other words, we're probably sitting there thinking right now, my gosh, I have enough going on with the pandemic and the economic situation and the job situation and the political wars and the cultural wars, and now I have to worry about the climate. Well, of course we do, because our climate is in serious issue right now, and it's not going away. And most importantly, it's not going to wait for us to be ready to deal with it. So let me bring my guest on. She is interesting background because she's a clinical psychologist, but always had this passion for climate change. So she's Margaret Klein Salomon. She's a clinical psychologist turned climate warrior. She's the founder of the Climate Mobilization, which pioneered the internationally recognized climate emergency declaration campaign. And again, the name of her new book is Facing the Climate Emergency: How to Transform Yourself with Climate Truth. And here's my guest, Dr. Margaret Klein Salomon. Dr. Margaret Klein Salomon, welcome to the show today. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we're talking about your new book, Facing the Climate Emergency: How to Transform Yourself with Climate Truth. I know you call yourself a climate psychologist. You were a therapist until 2014, and then you founded the Climate Mobilization. So tell us why you made that shift.
Well, I became so alarmed by the climate emergency. It felt like a red light was blinking in my face, and I felt like I really had to do something. But when it really came together for me and my life fundamentally changed was when a good friend said, "Don't start a blog," which is what I had been thinking about. "Discourse isn't enough. Think, what could you do to actually solve this?" And really, I had never let myself think that big. I had never thought, I mean, it's so huge, right? It's kind of insane. Oh, try to solve the climate emergency. But on the other hand, I think in many ways it's the only sane response to the incredibly extreme situation we find ourselves in. So for me, once that gauntlet was thrown, I realized there was nothing I had ever wanted more than to do everything that I could to protect humanity and the living world from this impending cataclysm.
Well, I love the advice that your friend gave to you. So you founded this company, this nonprofit. You're the founder and executive director of the Climate Mobilization. So what's your vision, a short synopsis of your vision there?
The Climate Mobilization advocates a World War II scale response to the climate emergency. So that includes strong command and control policies from the federal government, such as banning all new fossil fuel infrastructure. That's a policy that we advocate, you know, right off the bat, as well as investing massively in the transition itself to, you know, build a smart grid and put solar on every roof and insulate every home for energy conservation and help America's farmers transition to all organic agriculture and bind carbon into the soil. So there's just so much to do that really only the federal government, in cooperation with business, labor, and the whole society, can achieve the kind of the race to zero emissions, the rapid transformation in every sector of our economy that we need. So, yeah, that's the end goal, is this all out, all hands on deck mobilization to restore a safe climate.
Right.
And but so obviously that's a huge goal, but we've pursued it over the past 5 years in a variety of ways, including policy development. We wrote a 100-page document describing the vision of World War II scale climate mobilization. And then our biggest campaign has been the climate emergency campaign. We helped pioneer this tactic, and now more than 1,500 global governments have declared a climate emergency, mainly local governments. Just last week, something like 270 South Korean local governments declared a climate emergency in a coordinated push to get stronger national action. So it's really taken off as a way for local governments and the citizens and residents of those communities and the climate organizations around the country to basically reset their local climate policy. And, you know, take a step back at, like, okay, this is an emergency. And so there, in some examples, like in Ann Arbor, Michigan, for example, they declared a climate emergency and then released a $1 billion plan to reach zero emissions by 2030, which is very ambitious in scale for such a small city, and the timeline is extremely ambitious. So,
well, that's
so
where
that's
it starts.
The kind of transformative action that we're looking for with these climate emergency declarations, as well as, of course, bringing the local governments, like they saw in South Korea, bringing the local governments into an advocacy position themselves.
Right.
So
it's absolutely where it starts, in small organizations, small groups, local politics. So good for you. Well done. Let's talk a little bit about the book. Well-known environmentalist and author Bill McKibben describes your book as a remarkable account of how you can become a climate warrior. On the blog that you did start, you called Facing the Climate Emergency as a self-help guide for all who are struggling with the pain of climate emergency. And I know your goal is to help readers become the most effective warrior that they can be. Why did you feel compelled to write this book now?
I wrote it because through my experience, both as a psychologist and an organizer building this organization, I felt like I was having the same conversations over and over again. So many people have the same questions and are dealing with the same issues. And those are, they're feeling overwhelmed, they're feeling alienated, they're in grief, they're angry, they're terrified. And then the key question that comes up over and over and over and over, what can I do?
Right.
People are desperate for guidance. So I wanted to try and, address these very real challenges.
Right. And you start the book painting the somewhat bleak but true picture of where we are in America. You know, 1 in 6 takes psychiatric medicines. Suicide rates are at the highest point in 50 years. We watch over 33 hours of television a week. And I'm guessing you wrote this pre-pandemic, right?
That's right.
And so now we've got that to add on top of it. So I guess my question is, and this is a question I get asked a lot, especially if I've worked in documentary film, is why should I care now? I've got so much on my plate. You know, we've got people hurting financially. We've got people, not able to cope because of the virus and the political situation right now. And why should I take on one more cause here? And let's be clear, I'm not questioning climate change is at a critical level. It's real. Science proves it. We only have to be mildly informed to know that as fact. But I'm questioning, as a human being, how do you reach people as human beings to make that connection and get them involved?
So one way is, one key link between with everything that's going on is just the horrible reality that our system is broken. I can't think of a more clear definition of broken than it is literally headed for collapse and the deaths of billions of people. That's a failure. And the staggering levels of inequality and racism that we're seeing this is not working. And that is a really terrible thing. I wish I lived in a functional society and country and world, but we don't. But there is a very real opportunity here to fix it, to build a world that treasures life and works for everyone. And the political conditions are so hot right now, obviously, as we're seeing with this bursting forth of the Black Lives Matter movement into the top of the national consciousness. And that's great, because it's the status quo, again, it's done. It has failed. And now it's up to all of us to build the new order. And the only way it's going to work is if it starts with a race to zero emissions and drawdown, because this thing is so far along that we are off the cliff, and we need to not hit the brakes but hit reverse.
Right, and you know, not a day too soon. So I want to look at what you call the five steps of facing the climate emergency. And of course, you go into this in great detail in the book, but I'd like to take a high level look and begin with step one, which is face climate truth. And there are people out there who, despite the science, despite, you know, horrifying pictures of before and after, you know, just 12 months apart, still do not believe this is happening. What do you say to them?
One thing that I say is, wow, I really wish that were true, because that's what it is. It's a wish. It's a wish that they're confusing with reality, but it's a wish that we share. So on that level, we have that in common. But I will also tell people, I'm sorry to inform you, but the fossil fuel industry, the most profitable industry in human history, has engaged in a multi-billion-dollar campaign of lies and deception. And I'm sorry to tell you, but they've gotten you. They've invested heavily to fool people. And not bad news for you.
Yeah, I'm not sure that changes people's minds. It's very difficult if people are in that situation and they just, you know, they have this bias toward believing something and aren't open to new things. You say the goal of the book is to make us, not to make us feel less pain, it's actually to make us get in touch with our pain so we can turn it into constructive action. And I think that's important to mention here, because, you know, there are some, you know, dire truths that we have to face if we're going to make change. So let's look at step two. You talk about welcome fear, grief, and other painful feelings. Why did you include that in this book? Why is it that important?
The climate movement has come from a culture of science. Scientists were the ones that raised the alarm, and scientists are still considered to be kind of the experts on this topic. And, of course, climate science is critically important, but it is only one dimension of how we need to understand and process and approach this emergency. We need all human capabilities, all areas of study, all areas of expertise, fighting this fight, working on this crisis. So, yeah, so I want to bring my psychological knowledge, and the fact is that the culture of science is hyper-intellectual, rational, just the facts, really trying to stay away from emotion, and that hasn't, it just hasn't worked well. It hasn't, it has confused the public, because these are absolutely terrifying realities, and they deserve to be treated with the emotional resonance that, you know, this kind of news, that we're in danger, that it deserves. So for the most important example of this is the climate movement's long-held, multi-decade approach to fear, and the internal understanding that fear doesn't work as a motivator,
right,
and we can't scare people regarding climate. I consider this one of the worst ideas in the world, because fear is one of the most basic human motivators, mm-hmm, and motivators of other animals. It is a self-protective mechanism. It's how we turn a perception of a risk into self-protective action. And to try to avoid fear, self-consciously avoid fear, is a totally self-defeating action on the part of the climate movement. We need people to feel afraid, because that motivates them, and because it's an inherently scary, we've gotten into a really bad situation in the climate movement, where if you decide in advance that we can't scare people, but the truth is inherently terrifying, what do you do?
Yeah, I hear you on that, because I do think fear can be a very powerful motivator. I know it's certainly motivated me sometimes throughout my life.
Of course. So
I think also, if, you know, if there's no imminent fear there, that people tend to think, oh, well, you know, it's not an emergency, it's probably not going to happen in my lifetime. And, you know, we need to be thinking further than that, because we need to think of kids and grandkids and future generations. So let's look at step three, reimagine your life story. And you start that saying, it's likely clear to you that to protect humanity and the living world, you need to reconsider your fundamentals, like who are you, why are you here, what's your purpose, etc. So just talk to us a little bit about that, and how you encourage us to look at things through different eyes there.
The climate emergency is happening on such an epic scale that I believe it really is going to define our lives. Even if it might not feel like that today, I believe that people from my generation, anyway, I'm 33, that our lives will be dominated by this, and that is terrifying. But it is, again, also an opportunity for really heroism, that we are in danger. Collectively, there is a huge vacuum of leadership, and we need everyone. We need you to be in this fight. And I invite readers to think, what if this is actually why I'm here? What if everything in my life were leading up to this moment? All of my education and skills, all of the challenges that I've faced and the things I've learned along the way. So I want to help people find new meaning and a new mission in this new reality.
Mm. You know, when you look through history, I mean, our ancestors have had many challenges, and you mentioned this in step four. Step four is understand and enter emergency mode, and you know, some of the questions that you bring up there for discussion and reflection are, you know, what your family members did during World War II, and how their stories influenced their life along the way there. You know, did you know anybody during the AIDS crisis when that came out? I mean, if people hadn't actively got involved then, that could be a whole different story there. So talk to us a little bit more about understanding and entering emergency mode and how we get involved from there.
The concept of emergency mode is the idea that there is a fundamentally different way of living, mental activity and all kinds of activity, when you recognize that you're in an emergency. You focus on achieving safety. You put all available resources towards solving the emergency, and it is your overwhelming top priority. Individuals can enter emergency mode in a situation like a house fire or a deadly illness, all kinds of situations. And whole countries can enter emergency mode, such as we're seeing some versions of it with coronavirus in terms of solving the emergency become the top priority, massive investment. But the best example is World War II, because it was during World War II that the United States transitioned its entire economy from a consumer economy to a war economy in just a few years. And through an all-hands-on-deck collaboration led by the federal government, but deeply involving business, labor, and the American people, we were able to win the war, arm our allies, shock the world by just blowing through every production target, and create the modern age. So this is what we need to do. I mean, it's different, and thankfully, it's not a war. This is just a race to save as much life as possible from an external force that we've been creating.
Right.
But so.
And so, largely built by that consumer society that you just mentioned.
Absolutely. But right, the society built post-war was, there is certainly an irony there. World War II was a huge use of fossil fuels, and then after the war we built the highways and absolutely built the infrastructure that is a huge part of the problem. So that, absolutely.
Yeah.
But during the mobilization itself, when we were in emergency mode, there was serious curtailment of consumption, such as rationing of gasoline, tires, meat, sugar, and an ethic of participation. So 40% of vegetables were grown at home in Victory Gardens because, all hands on deck. So I think that, top incomes during the war, top earners were taxed at a 94% highest marginal tax bracket. So when you're in that mode, when there is a real sense that everyone shares that we have to do this, it's not a choice, it's not a nice to have, it's this or absolute devastation, that it's just such a fundamental change that I think we can't even imagine what we will be able to accomplish if we really enter that mode.
I just did an interview with Dr. Joseph Cardillo on the 12 areas of attention. It's so true that what we pay attention to is what gets changed, basically. And so you make some very valid points there. So step five in your book, join the climate emergency movement. Now, you know, some, I'm going to call them fringe participants, if you will, give environmentalism and climate change a bad name. And then you've got people who, to me, seem very genuine, like the young Greta Thunberg, who's received the most horrific criticism and just trash talk. It's been awful. What do you advise people when they're getting into this kind of situation and they're trying to get involved and bring other people on board?
Just that we have to do it. It's not that it's easy or that it's all fun and games. Certainly, organizing, you know, community organizing, grassroots organizing, political organizing, it is challenging. And the hate from the right wing, creating family tensions when and you know there's all sorts of or whatever conflicts in organization conflicts. There's all sorts of issues, but.
So your ultimate call.
We need to overcome them because if we don't create this change, then we're toast.
Yeah, and so your ultimate call to action is to get involved, and we can do that on many different levels. We do not have to be out there front, you know, facing everybody. There are many organizations where we can work in the background and support them. So what else would you like to say about your call to action there?
I encourage people to go all in, meaning. And that does look different for different people, but if you can take a year off your school or your work and do this full time, if you can, move, take a roommate or move in with your parents or whatever, or retire early or move to 3 days a week or whatever. This moment, I mean, it's 100 degrees in Siberia. This moment is here, and it's all moving very quickly. So, this is not the time for half measures on the personal level either.
Yeah. Well, you know, being still stuck in the middle of this pandemic here, I think it's going to be challenging for some people to get involved. But those that are interested in this and have a passion for it, I mean, the time is as good as any, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I wish we had been doing this 20 years ago, but in lieu of that, how about right now?
Yeah. Well, the book is called... Facing the Climate Emergency, How to Transform Yourself with Climate Truth. I know listeners can find out much more about Dr. Margaret Klein-Salomon at the website, which again is, let's have a look, it's theclimatemobilization.org. A final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
You can get a free introductory chapter at facingtheclimateemergency.com. And yeah, I'd love to hear from you about your experience reading the book.
All right, Margaret Klein-Salomon, thank you so much for being with us today. And I want to thank listeners for being with us today. If you have questions, comments, or feedback on today's conversation, you can reach me at conversationslive.net. We've got more than 1,000 guest interviews, more than 700 podcasts at conversationslive.net. And you can chat with me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair. Hope you'll tune in next week. Until then, please stay safe, stay strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicky's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.